This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. In today's podcast, the theme is cancer. Today, we're going to talk to one of America's foremost integrative oncologists. They're few and far between. There are some complementary physicians who are not per se trained in oncology, but they tackle cancer patients like myself. But people who are actually formally trained in oncology and who treat cancer patients, there are not that many of them, we're going to be talking to Dr. Dwight McKee. Now, I'm going to give you a little background on Dr. McKee because our acquaintance goes way back, because when we were both fledgling doctors, we both graduated from medical training. Early in our careers, we met. We met in a very, very unusual setting. We met in the offices of Dr. Emmanuel Ravisi, who was a legendary alternative cancer practitioner. Literally, he was a living legend because he practiced for decades, well into his 90s. He was, I think he was about 88 or 90 when both of us were shadowing him in his practice in New York City. He was very, very unconventional in his approach. He sometimes pulled off miracles, and we were there to witness it. I went on to practice sort of general practice of complementary medicine. Dr. McKee, however, was inspired to go back and take advanced training in oncology. He went through a very time-consuming and arduous fellowship in the field of hematology and oncology, so that he would have the specific credentials that would enable him to treat cancer patients, not necessarily with just Dr. Ravisi's protocols, but with both conventional and natural methods. Just to give you a little more background, he graduated from Williams College. Then he got his MD, PhD at Case Western Reserve, and then ultimately went back and got his hematology-oncology fellowship credentials. And then he was subsequently became board certified and became a visiting scientist at the Scripps Research Institute of Immunology, where he studied immunology, specifically tumor immunology. He has been involved in the development of integrative cancer care, trying to create a synthesis between conventional cancer medicine and alternative complementary medicine. He didn't eschew conventional chemotherapy, radiation, but tried to augment it with natural methods. He has recently turned his attention to supplement formulation, and he's got a new book coming out next month. It's entitled After Cancer Care. We're going to find out all about that, because that's a very fascinating proposition. Okay, once you've been treated, they say, okay, people ask, what do I do now? And basically, doctors say, we'll wait till the other shoe drops. Hopefully, you're cured. Patients don't know what to do. In the meantime, his book offers specific advice. So without further ado, here's Dr. Dwight McKee. It's great sort of reconnecting with you after, literally pretty much 3 decades. That was, we were both young doctors with the fire in the belly, sitting in Dr. Ravisi's office in the 1980s.
Yes, Ron. It's great to talk with you again. I think we actually were at the last time we saw each other was maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I believe, at an American College of Nutrition meeting in the maybe early 2000, something like that. But right. I know I've seen you since the Ribisi days.
Indeed.
And have kept tabs on your flourishing career, and congratulations on all that you do and have accomplished.
So let's go back in a time capsule. Let's talk about Emmanuel Ribisi, because really, really interesting case study in alternative cancer practice. Can you recall for us what it was like to sit in that office?
Well, it was, I met Ribisi when we both spoke on the same symposium. It was one of the first integrative cancer symposia. It was called Cancer Dialogue 80. And at the time, I was running a cancer hospital in Mexico based on the Kelly program, who was the first person that I had had studied as far as alternative cancer therapies. I spent 12 years studying many different approaches to alternative cancer therapies, but the two that I studied the most were Kelly's and Ribisi's.
And just for our listening audience, Dr. William Donald Kelly was the inspiration for a frequent visitor here to Intelligent Medicine, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who has an integrative cancer practice here in New York. So, you really spent some quality time with some of the people who are doing some of the most interesting work in the latter part of the 20th century in cancer, specifically alternative cancer, because they didn't use anything that was conventional. They didn't use chemotherapy. They didn't use radiation. They just used these innovative natural approaches.
Ribisi actually started his work before there was any chemotherapy or radiation.
Right. In the 1920s or 30s, perhaps, yeah.
In the 1920s, yeah. He published his first paper in 1918.
Wow.
He was born in 1896, and he died just shy of his 102nd birthday.
Wow.
And he was, as you said, so he was 83 when I met him, or 84, when I met him at the Cancer Dialogue 80, and he was interested in what I presented because Kelly's system was a dualistic system, which Ribisi's was also. So Kelly was talking about the dualism in the autonomic nervous system, generally speaking, that people with solid tumors needed more parasympathetic tone, and people with hematologic malignancies needed more sympathetic tone. That was his idea of metabolic types, and he synthesized
roughly paralleling recommendations on the one hand to put people on very strict juicing, vegetarian regimens, or alternatively putting them on a high protein meat-based diet.
Three meals of fatty meat a day, mm-hmm. for the people that he needed to make more sympathetic. And Kelly was to my mind a medical intuitive. He was an intelligent man, and he was a good synthesizer of other people's work. He brought in coffee enemas from Gerson, although he didn't make those attributions. But he clearly gathered work that had existed before him. But then there were some things that he just intuitively knew and would integrate into his program. Ribisi was very much more of a hard scientific type of individual, and Ribisi didn't consider himself an alternative cancer doctor. I mean, when Ribisi started Trafalgar Hospital in New York City and was treating cancer patients, there was no profession of oncology. I mean, the first oncology boards came about in the late 60s and early 70s. So there wasn't an oncology profession per se when he was at the height of his work. He published his major work in 1961, and chemotherapy was very rudimentary at that time. And what Ribisi had noted was that there was a dualism, and he used the terms anabolic and catabolic to describe that dualism. And, of course, the ancient Asian medicines were all dualistic, and, we're all familiar with the Chinese medicine concepts of yin and yang. so this thread runs through it, And I've found Ravisi's principles to be of use to me in dealing with conventional medical oncology content by seeing, obviously, things that were catabolic. For instance, when I was giving high-dose interleukin-2 to melanoma patients back in the early 90s, it was obvious that this created a very catabolic, in Ravisi's terms, a very catabolic situation, a lot of leaky vessels, and that's what you get with kind of a cytokine storm, which is what you're provoking with high-dose IL-2, which works in about 10% of melanoma patients. Of course, we have much better breakthrough therapies in melanoma now on the conventional side. And as an aside, I would say that it's my view that we are at a very early part of a paradigm shift in conventional oncology from what we could call the age of chemotherapy the last 50, 60 years, to the age of immunotherapy, which has taken 50 years to get traction. Mm-hmm. But it's clearly here now, and it's developing rapidly, and I think it will, in the next decade, really eclipse everything except surgery. I think it'll largely eclipse radiation therapy as well.
What prompted your career decision? Because I thought it was most interesting. You know, there was a long hiatus between the completion of your medical training, your studies with Dr. Kelly, and then Dr. Ravisi, gathering information. So instead of becoming sort of a renegade alternative practitioner using purely natural methods to treat cancer, you went back to school, which is a hard thing to do, and, you know, spent years studying basically how to administer chemotherapy, and, you know, towing the line, because your views about natural methods of treating cancer were probably not well received, so you probably kept a low profile.
I kept those to myself. Yeah,
but so
I've often joked I know what it's like to be gay and in the closet.
Right. So you had to kind of keep
a
low profile.
I was an alternative cancer doctor in the closet doing a hemonc, fellowship. So it also motivated me to be, you know, to really excel and not just get by, because I figured if my past ever caught up with me, I didn't want to be in any way marginal. So, you know, I was the best of all the fellows and residents because I just put a lot into it. And I found it really interesting. I sort of took the approach of psychologically of, okay, I've lived in this medical culture, which is completely foreign to and pretty much polarized with conventional medicine. I'm going to go back into conventional medicine. So I took the attitude that I was like a medical anthropologist. I was going to go back and study the beliefs and practices mm-hmm. of this, you know, this strange tribe. And that really helped me kind of separate. There is a sort of a brainwashing process that goes on through medical training, and especially during internship, residency, and fellowship. Many of the same techniques are used that are used in the military to, brainwash is a funny term, but it really creates a very regimented view of reality. Okay, this is our reality,
right?
And you know, we're sticking to it. Well, so, I mean, there's sleep deprivation,
right?
Public humiliation.
Yes. like the drill sergeant, like the drill sergeant thing. You know, where they, and I remember this very well.
Exactly.
That, you know, you'd make a mistake, or they'd put you on the spot to come up with an answer, and you kind of mumble a half-hearted answer, and they would literally humiliate you, you know,
and you would
dress
go
you
look
down.
That up, and you would remember that the rest
yes.
of your life.
Yeah.
It's effective. But I already had a well-developed worldview when I went back into this training. So, I mean, I had already seen stage 4 cancer patients get well, which is, you know, not supposed to happen. So that, you know, what I was interested was in learning. Well, to answer your question, what motivated me to go back is I was frustrated with what I could accomplish mm-hmm. with alternative methods alone. And
so just to reiterate, you were not completely satisfied that these alternative methods, unassisted by some of the modern breakthroughs in cancer therapy, could sufficiently address the problems of the patients, that you were selling them short by saying, we're going to put you on a special diet, we'll, you know, give you proteolytic enzymes, et cetera. That alone, I mean, there are benefits, but that just wasn't enough.
Yeah. I mean, I really just had a gut feeling that if you were able to use the content of conventional therapies a little more judiciously in a context of what I had been exploring in the alternative cancer world, and now we call that integrative oncology, you know, what I was doing in the late 1970s was called cancer quackery by the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Now it's integrative oncology. So we have made a lot of progress in my, you know, professional lifetime. but I just had this feeling that, you know, having the potency of some of the conventional treatments, along with the ability to really change the internal terrain that those cancer cells are living with, which is what I think is the main thing that we do with complementary therapies, with diet, with nutrition, with exercise, with stress management. It all changes the terrain that those cancer cells are living in. And there are actually markers that, you know, that the integrative community have derived, such as, you know, in inflammatory markers, and we know that inflammation is friendly to cancer. A chronic inflammatory terrain cancer likes, and it seeks to perpetuate it by pulling in immune cells and getting them to fire off inflammatory compounds, which they actually help the cancer progress and spread and so forth. So I just felt that putting those two together was worth the investment of 6 years of my time to do. And I was extremely gratified to see that I was able to accomplish more by putting these two worlds together than I was with either one alone. And I had good experience with, you know, because during my fellowship and some in my residency, when I was doing oncology and hematology rotations, I was, you know, involved in, I was part of applying conventional only. So I can remember somewhere in the middle of that training saying to myself, geez, you know, we were doing better than this with the alternative stuff.
Right, you must have had to really bite your tongue during your residency at times because you're ready to chime
in.
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really did. And, you know, because the long-term success rate in stage 4 cancers, you know, with the exceptions of germ cell tumors and lymphomas and now melanoma, you know, has been pretty close to zero in conventional therapy, and I've participated in and saw alternative therapies where it was, you know, somewhere between 10% and 20%. That's a lot higher than, you know, 0 to 2. but it's still the minority. We knew that we could get, and it still is the case. We know that we can get dramatic responses and durable responses in stage 4 cancer patients, but we can't tell who they'll be. We can't predict, you know, so we just do our best and see what the outcome is. It's clear in my mind that there are very significant ways that we can protect people from chemotherapy. And as I said, I think that's going to become less and less of an issue. Early on, I got involved with in vitro chemosensitivity testing. That is a, you know, a system of taking a biopsy of a tumor, taking about a gram of tumor, and culturing it in tissue culture with a lot of different agents, and, you know, looking under the microscope to see which ones kill most or all of the cancer cells, and then applying that clinically. And there's complex political and economic reasons why this never got traction in the mainstream, but it clearly improved my results and all the doctors that I knew that used it. But you know, you had to commit to doing at least a dozen cases to be able to see it, because it doesn't work all the time. And just because it works in the lab doesn't mean for sure that it'll work in the patient, but it certainly stacks the deck in their favor.
Well, you mentioned the phrase protect people from chemotherapy. You know, these days, there's a big conflict. Patients are sort of like deer in the headlights, because they'll go to a complementary or alternative practitioner. Let's say we'll take this, that, and the other supplements. They're good for you and they're compatible with chemo. And then you'll get the advice often from oncologists, oh, don't take anything, because all that stuff could interfere with the benefits of the chemo and maybe protect the cancer cells. So, sometimes they just say, well, just take a Centrum,
really only,
take a one-a-day multivitamin or something.
At this point, really, if that. I mean, I've heard many radiation oncologists tell their patients not to eat blueberries or kale.
Yeah.
Because they're worried about the antioxidants interfering with the radiation, which to my mind is, worrying about a deer in front of a freight train derailing it. Not likely.
Right.
It's frustrating because a lot of crucial questions that are relevant to hundreds of thousands of patients, because there are things that they're doing that they're not telling their oncologists about, or that they want to do, or that they're and you can't get funding to address these questions. So you look at lots of little studies, and on the evidence that we have suggests that quote unquote antioxidants, which is a bad term, and extends far beyond vitamin E, C, A, and carotenoids. I mean, there are many, many botanical compounds that are actually behave as oxidants in tumor cells and antioxidants in normal cells. It's a redox. You have to have taken chemistry to understand that. So I don't want to get too technical for our audience, but it boils down to a little saying that I like: plants are smart and drugs are dumb. Drugs only do one thing, and plants will do different things, and they'll do the things that you want. Like, curcumin protects normal cells from radiation and enhances the effect of radiation.
Right. Most studies are showing that now. Yeah. So it has desirable effects both ways. It may shield the healthy cells without shielding the cancer cells, and in fact, may even accelerate the destruction of the cancer cells. So it's quite ideal in that sense.
Exactly. So it's very difficult to get funding to address these kinds of questions, which are extremely clinically relevant to patients. The oncologist will say, "Well, we don't have any randomized trials to tell us that that's safe or that that doesn't interfere." So really, the only way that you can do truly integrative cancer therapy is, if you're like me, when I was practicing oncology, I was running the show, so I would give my patients supplements and talk to them about their diet and get them to exercise and get them to practice stress reduction practices, and I use the tools of medical oncology as judiciously and as targeted a way as I could. And I had much better results than what I saw when I was doing it as a fellow in the hospital, where all they were getting was conventional cancer therapy.
And Jell-O.
And Jell-O. Say again? Yes.
And Jell-O.
And Jell-O.
Right. Or Ensure.
Yes.
Or Ensure.
Would you like fries with that?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So it's frustrating, but at the same time, I think there's a lot of there has been a lot of progress. I wanted to finish that thought. So really the only way you can do integrated cancer therapy is if the oncologist is doing it, or the oncologist has a relationship with an integrated practitioner that they trust. They've seen better outcomes in the patients who are seeing them. And I do know some practitioners who, you know, get referrals from oncologists, and they say, you know, do your thing, because, you know, my patients do better when they see you. But those are, you know, those are kind of few and far between. And the typical situation is as you described. The oncologists say, no, don't use anything. You know, we don't know if these things might interfere with what we're doing. I think that's going to become much less of an issue as we shift from, over the next 2 decades, from the age of chemotherapy to the age of immunology, because I think it'll become clear that these kind of complementary supportive care practices are only going to enhance, you know, the outcomes when we're dealing with immunotherapy.
This is a good point at which to pause, because we've sort of laid out some of our general caveats and principles here and introduced you to our audience. Dr. Dwight McKee is dually trained. He's got an excellent background, having studied with some of the real giants in the field of alternative cancer treatment, but also has undergone a rigorous conventional oncology training program. And he combines the best of both worlds in a new book that he is about to introduce. We'll talk a little bit about the book After Cancer Care by today's guest, Dr. Dwight McKee, when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Please turn to part 2 to rejoin the conversation. This is Intelligent Medicine.